National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns, is brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check out their website at cybersecuritysummit.org for a list of their upcoming webinar series. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, and you've joined us for this edition of National Security This Week. We get together every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're fortunate enough to be joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us learn more about national security challenges and opportunities. We have a fantastic show for you today. We're going to talk about the U.S. National Security Council and some crises around the world. Our guest is Steve Andreasen, who's a national security consultant to the Nuclear Threat Initiative and its Global Nuclear Policy Program in Washington, D.C. He teaches courses on national security policy and crisis management in foreign affairs at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Steve served as Director for Defense Policy and Arms Control on the U.S. National Security Council at the White House from February of 1993 to January of 2001. He was the principal advisor on strategic policy, nuclear arms control, and missile defense to the National Security Advisor and to the President. During the George H.W. Bush and Reagan administrations, Andreasen served in the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs and the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, dealing with a wide range of defense policy, arms control, nuclear weapons, and intelligence issues. As a Presidential Management Fellow, he served as Special Assistant to Ambassador Paul Nitze in the U.S. State Department, focusing on strategic arms reduction talks, and as a Foreign Policy and Defense Legislative Assistant in the office of U.S. Senator Al Gore, Jr. Andreasen received his Bachelor of Arts from Gustavus Adolphus College in 1984 and earned his Master of Arts from the Humphrey School in 1986. His articles and opinion pieces have been published in Foreign Affairs, The Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the St. Paul Pioneer Press, the Boston Globe, and many other outlets. Steve Andreasen, welcome to National Security This Week.
John, it's a pleasure to be here.
You are in studio with us, which is really nice.
It's nice to make the drive down to Northfield and to get back into southern Minnesota.
Well, we're glad you were able to join us today. It took us a little time to organize the date, but I'm glad we were able finally to get this together. I've been looking forward to the show for a long time.
You
have a tremendous reputation, professional reputation. Steve, let me begin today's show by asking you, what attracted you to a career in the national security arena? I mean, was it your undergraduate studies at Gustavus Adolphus in St. Peter? You earned a master's at the Humphrey School. Clearly, you had some interest in this area. What was it that brought you into the kind of the national security world? And clearly, there's something that attracted you to this field. You applied to the State Department and served some really interesting positions in the national security arena.
Well, even earlier than Gustavus Adolphus College, I grew up in Richfield.
Okay.
And my father served in the Korean War, and I remember growing up being fascinated by his experience, not only serving in the military, but also just serving overseas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at that time, we got our international news from the News Weeklies, Time and Newsweek. Mm-hmm. And my parents always, ensured that we had those magazines lying around the house. And that was really my first exposure, you know, and interest to things happening, you know, outside the living room and outside of school. So I ended up going down to Gustavus for 4 years after graduating from Richfield High School. You know, had the classic liberal arts education. I ended up with a major in political science, but minored in economics and English and biology.
Okay.
And really made a late break for my interest in government and national security, and went right to the Humphrey School after I graduated. Okay. And ended up focusing on national security and foreign policy there.
Was their program at the Humphrey School at the time really strong on the global public policy side?
So to be honest, seems like only yesterday, but this was back in 1984 to 1986. And they had two or three people at the Humphrey School who were outstanding in national security and foreign policy. The dean of the school was a gentleman by the name of Harlan Cleveland, who served in the Kennedy administration and actually, for example, served and supported the XCOM during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So he was an interesting asset at the Humphrey School.
Yeah.
But two professors, one of whom just retired, a gentleman by the name of Robert Kuderle, who headed up their international econ and trade program. And then John Brandel, who unfortunately passed away a few years back. But John served in the Pentagon. He was one of Robert McNamara's whiz kids during the Vietnam era. So they had, you know, two or three people who were very strong. But I did a lot of my coursework in other departments at the University of Minnesota. I took a lot of courses from the econ department and also from the political science department.
It's amazing to me how much economic considerations drive national security decision making. So that makes, you know, great sense to me that you spent a lot of time taking those courses. So what was it that that advanced you out to Washington, D.C. in this career that you started in the national security world?
Yeah, well, it was a fortuitous elevator ride, in my case, in between my first and second year at the Humphrey School. I mentioned Bob Kuderle, who was a professor at the Humphrey School. And I was down that summer. At that time, they were located in the Social Sciences Tower. After my first year, they moved to what is now the Humphrey Center. But I went down and got in the elevator on the first floor to go up to the ninth floor, which is where the Humphrey School was. And Bob Kuderle got on the elevator with me. And he said to me, are you familiar with the Presidential Management, at that time, internship, now fellowship program? And I said, no, I hadn't heard of it. And he said, you should really apply for that. And the door opened on the ninth floor, and Bob walked out, and I decided that that was sound advice, even though I had never heard of the program before. So long story short, I ended up the fall of my second year at the Humphrey School applying to be a presidential management intern.
Okay.
And was accepted in the program in the spring of my second year. And ended up going to Washington, D.C. as a presidential management intern with a short break. I had been selected as a presidential management intern in April or May that spring of 1986 and decided that before getting a position, because it doesn't guarantee you a job in the federal government, what the program is the federal government still today select a couple hundred of people out of graduate programs and law schools and public health programs to be hired into the federal government directly without going through the civil service hiring procedures. But you have to find a job. They don't just give you one. But although I had gone out to Washington a couple of times to see if I could secure a job before I graduated, I didn't, and decided that I would travel my first trip overseas. So I went to Australia, New Zealand, and Fiji in the summer of 86 and came back and then was hired by a gentleman by the name of Dick Clark, who some of your listeners might know, a longtime national security expert and specialist, was very prominent in the 9/11 era, post-9/11. And Dick, at that time, was serving in the Intelligence Bureau of the State Department, and he hired me as a presidential management fellow.
All right. So you started at INR at State.
I did. So the Intelligence and Research Bureau, or INR as you call it, was my home bureau, and I served there 6 months doing analysis on then arms control negotiations between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. It was the last 2 years of the Reagan era. But one of the great things about the Presidential Management Now Fellowship Program, or PMF program still today, is you can do rotations. And Dick was very insistent that all of the PMFs he hired, and there were four or five of us, do rotations during our 2 years as a presidential management fellow. So after my 6 months in the Intelligence Bureau working as an arms control analyst, I then did a rotation working for a then young senator at the age of 39 who was running for president the first time, Al Gore. So I went up to his Senate staff and worked there for 6 months. And then I came back to the department and worked for really a legend in the U.S. national security bureaucracy, a gentleman by the name of Paul Nitze, who at that time was President Reagan's special advisor on arms control.
So I mentioned in the opening, and we've discussed a little bit here, the Bureau of Political Military Affairs and at the Department of State, and also the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, or INR, as it's called. Can you explain to our audience exactly what those two bureaus are?
Yeah, so the Bureau of Intelligence and Research is a unique bureau in the department. It's really a mini State Department within the department because it's organized as a global intelligence office. So it includes both regional and functional offices. I worked in the office that was a functional office working on arms control negotiations, but they had regional offices working on Europe and Asia and Latin America, et cetera. And
by functional, what we mean is it's a global issue, right? It's not tied to any one specific country or region. It's really an issue that crosses borders.
Exactly. So transnational threats, global economic issues, issues associated with terrorism, et cetera, were dealt with as functional issues as opposed to, you know, regional specific issues. And so, you know, the INR Bureau is unique because it's unique within the department. It's the largest bureau within the Department of State, true when I was there, I think still true today. It's staffed with about half Foreign Service officers, which staff most of the State Department, but also civil service officers. And I was a career civil servant as a Presidential Management Fellow, and then later I converted to the career civil service. And you know, it's a member of the intelligence community. So there's 15 or 16 different agencies spread across government who are members of the intelligence community. And INR, you know, has a vote at the table. It's a member of the community, just like the CIA or the military intelligence services. In that sense, it's a great place to get a sense as to what's happening in U.S. national security and foreign policy. The Bureau of Political Military Affairs, also a functional bureau, is a policy bureau. It's not an intelligence entity. So this is the bureau in the Department of State that, for example, did arms control negotiations. And the Political Military Affairs Bureau is where I spent, after my first 2 years in government, my second 4 years, which basically was the first Bush administration. The gentleman who hired me in the Intelligence Bureau, Dick Clark, was asked to head the Bureau of Political Military Affairs during the first Bush administration.
George H.W. Bush.
Exactly. Yeah. And he asked me to come work with him in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs. So I transitioned from the Intelligence Bureau to the Bureau of Political Military Affairs and went from intelligence to policy.
Okay. And I would say, so I was a career intelligence officer in the Navy, had many dealings with INR. It's my opinion that some of the best geopolitical analysts, intel analysts in the entire intelligence community, all now 18 members with the Space Force just added their own intelligence branch to the U.S. Space Force. And so they now are 18 members of the intel community. But INR at State had some of the best analysts in the entire community. Really fantastic.
So at the risk of being a homer, I talk about INR the way I talk about the Minnesota Vikings, okay. Which is they can, you know, literally do no wrong in terms of my passions and my fandom. But I agree with you. The Intelligence and Research Bureau is really extraordinary. Within the department, when I started there, George Shultz, who was the Secretary of State, had tremendous trust and confidence. It was led by a career ambassador, a gentleman by the name of Mort Abramowitz, who was one of the few career senior Foreign Service officers at the time. There were only three or four of them who reached that level of service. And the analysts were just outstanding. So it was a great place to start, as is the intelligence community. I tell my students, I now teach at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota, that the best place they can start their career in national security and foreign policy is serving in intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I'd agree. Yeah. We have one other question I want to get to before we take a quick break. Last question for this segment. What exactly is the National Security Council? Let's pivot over to that. Why was it established and when? What does it do and how does it support the President of the United States?
So the National Security Council, or NSC as it is known by acronym, actually was created in 1947 after World War II in something called the National Security Act, which also unified the Department of Defense and created the Central Intelligence Agency. So it wasn't just legislation focused on creating the NSC. It actually was legislation that really reorganized the national security community to deal with post-World War II challenges. And the NSC was set up then and is meant still today to be the central entity within the U.S. government for coordinating U.S. national security and foreign policy. It has a few statutory members who serve on the National Security Council, the president, the vice president, and a few other cabinet members. It then also has a NSC staff. So the National Security Council is different than the National Security Council staff.
Yeah.
But the staff basically supports the council and supports the president. So in brief, we can go into this in more detail. But we will. Yeah. The NSC really came into its own during the Kennedy administration. It existed under Presidents Truman and Eisenhower, and they both certainly used the NSC staff, but it was really Kennedy who organized the staff in a way that it's still organized today with a national security advisor, a deputy national security advisor, and then professional staff who, again, to use the terms we were using previously, cover regions and functions relating to U.S. national security and foreign policy.
Okay. For our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Steve Andreasen, who teaches at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota, and we're discussing the U.S. National Security Council and how to deal with international crises. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. You can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. So, Steve, let's get a little more depth on the National Security Council. I've always found that organization to be absolutely fascinating, and really more the staff than the statutory members. They make the decisions, but all of the work that has to go in on the staff side is what has always fascinated me. Now, you served as a staff member on the National Security Council staff. What does the day-to-day work look like on the National Security Council staff? What are you doing on a daily basis to create policy and implement strategy in support of American national security interests? I would imagine the interagency process is vitally important to these efforts. Can you give us sort of a sense of how the president establishes national security policy objectives and how the National Security Council staff helps to implement those policies?
So beginning somewhat tongue-in-cheek, the best description of the NSC staff was by one of my colleagues. I worked on the NSC staff all 8 years of the Clinton-Gore administration, so from 1993 to 2001. And he said once that the NSC staff was a little bit like being assigned to the Soviet gulag. Okay. It was prolonged periods of sleep deprivation, punctuated by short, intense interrogations. And really, all of that was true. But the NSC staff is really the center of U.S. national security and foreign policy making. And what it is supposed to do and what it does when it's working well is primarily two functions. One is to coordinate. That is to coordinate U.S. national security and foreign policy, including the agencies involved, which include a whole host of agencies, the State Department, the Defense Department, the military services, the intelligence community, Department of Energy, Department of Treasury, now Homeland Security. They're all part of the U.S. national security foreign policy bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And someone has to coordinate their efforts in achieving various goals and objectives, or at least there should be someone doing that. And the NSC is really meant to be, first and foremost, the entity within the U.S. government that coordinates. And the second thing it needs to do, again, if it's functioning as it's intended and if it's doing what it should be doing, is to be a disciplinarian. You can imagine that in national security and foreign policy across the U.S. government, there has to be an entity that's basically watching to make sure that everyone's doing what the president wants them to be doing, and if they're not, that they can actually be held to account.
Mm-hmm.
So coordinator and disciplinarian are the two major functions of the NSC staff. There's other functions that the staff undertakes. I mean, the NSC staff is relatively small compared to other departments and agencies. During the Clinton era, we had about 100 professional staff, that is what we called senior directors and directors, who staffed the various regional and functional, offices of the NSC. And then we had about 100 support staff. So the entire organization was about 200 people,
okay,
which is relatively small,
yeah,
as U.S. departments and agencies go.
That's not big.
And we had, for example, in my office, the Office of Defense Policy and Arms Control, we were one of the larger offices, and we only had 6 officers, a senior director and 5 directors. So it's a relatively small organization. But you end up doing a lot of things within the rubric of being the coordinator and the disciplinarian. Among other things, you're the personal staff of the President of the United States. Mm-hmm. Those of you who've been to Washington know that the NSC staff is located in what we called at the time the old Executive Office Building, which is inside the White House complex. It's right across from the West Wing. And the National Security Advisor actually has his or her office in the West Wing. So it's very much the president's personal staff on national security and foreign policy. And you end up not only being the coordinator and the disciplinarian, but also the advisor. So you manage the interagency process on various policies that you're responsible for, but you also provide the president advice and counsel, either directly or through the National Security Advisor.
So it's always been my impression that on the National Security Council staff side of things, you have people who are experts in their areas. They have their finger on the pulse of what's happening across the intelligence community as all of that information, the analytical work, is coming in to keep them updated on what's happening with global affairs. And they, in their advice to the president, are advocating for certain policy options. And once the president has decided on those policy options, they are then responsible for implementing those policy pursuits across the interagency process. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's a very good description. I mean, the NSC staff, much to the annoyance of certain departments and agencies, in particular the State Department, does have a view. Mm-hmm. So, in theory, and actually in the Eisenhower administration, that was probably the time where the staff primarily was a coordinator, and the president still relied on cabinet secretaries, for example, the Secretary of State. In his era, John Foster Dulles, was a principal actor on national security and foreign policy, and the National Security Advisor was much less visible, much less active, and much less independent. That changed in the Kennedy era. And now both the National Security Advisor, the deputy, and the staff is called upon and expected to provide not just the process of coordination, but also its own independent recommendations, and is called upon to help develop policy options. And also, of course, crucially, once the president makes a decision, to make sure that those decisions are being implemented. So, I mean, the staff is really active across the board. It's active as a coordinator. It's active in terms of providing inputs to the policy development process. And it's very active in policy implementation. The staffing of the staff, I should just say, is also quite interesting. In my era, I would say about 2/3 of the staff was career officers, foreign service officers, civil service officers, military officers, intelligence officers, who were asked to do rotations or details of approximately 1 to 2 years on the NSC staff. About 1/3 of the staff were political appointees,
okay,
but the staff was nonpartisan.
Right.
The 2 national security advisors I served under President Clinton, Tony Lake and Sandy Berger, made that clear at every turn that we did not do politics.
Right.
We were a nonpartisan staff. And that is the way the staff really should function. So it has deep expertise called upon across the government, nonpartisan expertise. And even the political appointees, are very much meant to serve in a nonpartisan capacity.
And I would just say that you know, America traditionally up until probably 9/11, we really practiced a lot of strategic patience about what was happening out there in the world, and the policy implementation was very thoughtful. It was very driven by our differences, political differences domestically, stop at our shores, and everything that's overseas we collaborate on, regardless of political party. It was very, very nonpartisan. 9/11 sort of changed it from a diplomacy-centric or economic-centric approach with strategic patience more to a military-heavy. And then, of course, you know, I'd like to get into a little bit later with you, but we got a little politicized, unfortunately, in our pursuits of American national security interests.
So I, you know, agree with you generally, John. I mean, 9/11 changed so many things, you know, across our society and across our government. And in my 14 years in government, I served 2 years in the Reagan administration, a Republican administration, yeah. Then 4 years under the first President Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, also Republican, mm-hmm. and then 8 years under the Clinton-Gore administration, Democrats. And the structure of the National Security Council staff, but also how the government operated, I served with many of the same people in all of those capacities.
Right.
We were all career civil service or military service or intelligence service.
Yeah.
And we crossed paths, you know, throughout those 14 years. 9/11 started to change some of that organization, in part because the government was focused and really has been for much of the past 20 years on fighting and winning the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. That tends to skew how things are done. And that began in the second Bush administration, in part because of the personalities that were engaged, who, quite frankly, in the first Bush term simply didn't get along that well.
Yeah.
And the National Security Council didn't do what I said it could and should do under Condoleezza Rice the first 4 years.
Yeah.
And she had a difficult time because, you know, she was serving with some real titans, Colin Powell at State, Don Rumsfeld at Defense, Dick Cheney as Vice President.
Right.
And she had a hard time being the coordinator
right.
and the disciplinarian
right.
of that group.
Right, yeah.
So that started to change things. And the Obama administration brought it back to what I would say was more the norm. One of Obama's national security advisors, Susan Rice, I served with on the Clinton-era staff. She was a director working for Dick Clark, actually. At that time, who had gone to the NSC. I should add Tony Blinken was also an alumni of that staff back in the day. But then it all changed under the Trump administration in terms of how the NSC was set up and how it functioned or didn't function. And I would argue that, you know, we're still recovering from that 4 years.
Yeah. I do want to return to some more discussions on the National Security Council staff and the function of the National Security Council. We have to take just a short, about a minute break to recognize our sponsor, the Cybersecurity Summit. We'll be right back.
National Security This Week is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. The Cybersecurity Summit brings together cyber experts from industry, academia, and all levels of government to explore challenges, solutions, and opportunities in the cyber arena. The three-day summit includes speakers, workshops, discussions about advancing a cyber career, and keynote addresses by top leaders from across the cyber community. Learn more at cybersecuritysummit.org.
And we're back here at National Security This Week. Our guest today is Steve Andreasen. Steve, how has the composition of the National Security Council staff, we were just discussing that before we went to break. I know it kind of ebbs and flows as far as numbers. It got big during the Obama administration, is that right? And then kind of swung back a little bit under the Trump administration. Do you know where it's at today with the Biden administration as far as size goes?
Yeah, so in general, the size of the NSC staff has grown considerably since the Kennedy administration.
Mm-hmm.
The Kennedy NSC staff probably had between 15 and 20 staff. And as I said, during the Clinton era, there were five times that number of professional staff, about 100. The staff grew, actually under both the second Bush administration and the Obama administration, and part of that was because the functions of the staff grew. I mean, in the Clinton era, we actually added international economics to the NSC structure. And as different issues and challenges became more prevalent in U.S. national security and foreign policy, the staff grew, you know, to deal with those divergent and disparate issues. So I think the staff probably reached its peak in size under the Obama administration. I want to say it was about 250 or 300. It was reduced for a whole host of reasons under the Trump presidency. I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are under the Biden staff. My sense is it's smaller than the Obama staff, but probably larger than the Clinton staff.
Mm-hmm. And there's a document that's that Congress requires the president to produce. It's supposed to be done every year, the National Security Strategy. I believe the first one was mandated under the Reagan administration, first year of the Reagan administration. And the Reagan and Bush administrations, even the Clinton administration, produced them pretty regularly, annually. That has fallen off now. Most administrations get away with saying, well, the one we did last year is the same one for this year and the one after that. What is the National Security Strategy?
Yeah, so the National Security Strategy is required by statute. And you're right in terms of how it has evolved since the requirement for a National Security Strategy. Most administrations produce one during a term. So if you have a two-term president, you usually see two national security strategies, that is, that are done from A to Z. So my recollection in the Clinton era is that we had two national security strategies that were done, you know, as I say, kind of from A to Z. It's meant to be a comprehensive look at U.S. national security, foreign and defense policy, and can actually be a window on how any specific administration views its priorities and also its approach. For example, the first national security strategy in the second Bush administration that was produced actually articulated a post 9/11 strategy of preventive war and preemption and a rationale for it that was later used as a template for the war in Iraq. So you can read the national security strategies as I say, kind of a window into how the administration is prioritizing and how it is approaching various issues and problems. As a operational document, this won't surprise you, John, it actually, other than setting broad objectives and goals that do have an impact, you know, the day-to-day oftentimes is somewhat disconnected from the grand strategies that are articulated even under the best of intentions by any administration.
Yeah, I've always looked at the National Security Strategy as it's a document that helps the administration communicate not only internally to American citizens and to the Congress, frankly, about what it is the administration believes they want to accomplish for national security objectives, but perhaps more importantly, a way to communicate where the administration stands with our allies and friends and even potential adversaries around the world.
So that is exactly on point. That is what the National Security Strategy is not only meant to do, but often does. In the Clinton era, it was my office, the Office of Defense Policy and Arms Control, that coordinated the preparation of the U.S. National Security Strategy. In fact, we had a Navy captain who supervised that process during the first term, who later went on to be a three-star admiral and a member of Congress from Pennsylvania, a gentleman by the name of Joe Sestak.
Yeah.
But it was a massive effort. I mean, Joe basically was in the gulag working on the National Security Strategy. Not a lot of sleep and some short, intense interrogations. And, of course, coordinating a document like that government-wide is a massive undertaking.
So what's the impact for the national security strategy on the other the departments in the executive branch, like DOD or state? I mean, what do they take from that document, that master document?
So it can certainly, again, be an indication after an interagency process of review as to how the president, the vice president, and the administration view its priorities. So it can be significant in that it is not only, as you say, read by the public, but read by people working within the government. It's not the most significant or operational document, I'll just say, in that most administrations use two tools that are more relevant to the development and execution of U.S. national security and foreign policy. They have slightly different names for these tools, but you can find them in any administration and in any presidential library. They're the Presidential Review Directive, which is usually signed by the National Security Advisor on a topic. So, for example, in the first year of the Clinton administration, I supervised four presidential review directives, one on our policy on denuclearizing the states of the former Soviet Union and bringing the strategic nuclear arms agreements concluded in the previous administration into force, mm-hmm. One on U.S. policy on nuclear testing and the negotiation of a comprehensive test ban treaty, one on our policy on missile defense and the anti-ballistic missile treaty, and one looking at arms control, specifically nuclear arms control, beyond the treaties that had been agreed up to that point. And those reviews are interagency reviews that are conducted under the review directive, which identifies basically the questions that need to be answered to inform the analysis and then identifies options to be reviewed. Mm. And that process goes from the working level, coordinated by the NSC staff, up to the deputies, that is, deputies in various departments and agencies, and the principals, that is, the cabinet secretaries, before it goes to the president. And when that process concludes, the president almost always signs what is known, again, as a presidential decision directive.
Yep.
And those presidential decision directives, or PDDs, as we called them in the Clinton era, those are really the Bible, so to speak. Those are the sacred texts and have much more cachet and currency within the government than the national security strategy writ large.
Yeah. I've always kind of marveled at the amount of time and energy that seems to be put into crafting the national security strategy and how the press is always saying, well, why are you delayed on this? Why haven't you published this? And the document itself doesn't really provide that much guidance for the executive branch for what it is they're actually going to do.
It's really true. As I say, it's not in that sense an operational document.
Yeah.
It provides a snapshot of priorities. And by the way, that snapshot can then be reflected in the presidential reviews that are undertaken and the more operational presidential decision directives that the president ultimately signs. But if you're going to an interagency meeting, throwing down the national security strategy on the table oftentimes doesn't impress a lot of people.
Yeah.
Bringing the presidential decision directive that has been signed does.
Because that gives clear guidance as to what the president wants to see happen.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's pivot over to some to the global events. I absolutely want to take advantage of your knowledge and experience in this realm. In the run-up to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it was pretty clear that the Biden administration was really well supported by the U.S. intelligence community, and they made the decision to share some fairly sensitive intelligence with American allies and friends around the world, and frankly, with the public, with the press, global press. They built consensus, the administration did, among friendly nations, and there was a resolve to stand against Russia, and then once the Russians had invaded, to provide significant assistance, including significant lethal assistance to Ukraine to defend their territory. That commitment to Ukraine continues to stand, and I will say for now, because we always know that, you know, politics changes over time. Hopefully enough people realize that this, you know, it's in America's vital American national security interests, at least from my perspective, to defeat Vladimir Putin's plan to take over Ukraine. Based on your experience, how profoundly different is the Biden administration's playbook to release this level of information that they did in the run-up to the invasion, after the invasion, what they continue to do today to unmask Vladimir Putin's plans. How different is that considering what we've seen in the past? Well, let's start there, and I have probably some follow-up questions for you.
So I think historians are going to look back at the Biden administration's approach to intelligence sharing in the run-up to the war in Ukraine, and it will be one of the more remarkable things that transpired during the first Biden term. Now, it's not unprecedented, and in fact, the U.S. government has often shared intelligence, in particular with its closest allies. That's usually done very privately and very quietly. A lot of times the sources and methods used to develop that intelligence are sensitive, and the intelligence community is therefore sensitive about exposing them in ways that our potential adversaries or real adversaries might learn about our sources and methods and then basically cut them off, either if they're technical sources or human sources. So a lot of that intelligence sharing is done quietly, and it's done in a classified format, and it hasn't been shared publicly. Now, there's been occasions when it has, and I would just point out, for example, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy was made aware of photographs taken by U-2 spy planes over Cuba that initially exposed the missiles that the Soviet Union was deploying there. And he basically sent representatives of his government around to share with our close allies, in particular in NATO, those photographs. However, they were also unveiled publicly by our ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, in a famous session of the UN Security Council and General Assembly, where he unveiled those photographs, which was quite striking at the time. So it was really not the norm. I think what the Biden administration has done in the run-up to the invasion might turn out to be more the norm because it's proven to be quite effective. Not only did we share the intelligence privately that indicated that the Russians were planning to invade Ukraine, beginning with the Ukrainians, who initially doubted that intelligence, but also our allies. But we also made it public. And a number of things resulted from that. First of all, I think it limited the options that Vladimir Putin and the Russian government had in terms of what they were planning in the run-up to the invasion. They were planning a number of what we call false flag operations, where they were going to claim that they were being attacked, you know, by Ukraine, and they were responding to an attack. And, you know, by exposing that as a tactic, it made it much less effective. It should also, however, be noted that it didn't stop Vladimir Putin from invading Ukraine. So, you know, its utility, I think, was proven to be significant, and I think more administrations will do the same in the future. You're going to see a lot more public sharing of intelligence to try and shape the actions of foreign governments and expose what we know they might be trying to accomplish. But again, I think we should be somewhat careful to assume that it's a game changer. It didn't change the game in the context of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And I should also note that it hasn't necessarily meant that all countries are on our side.
Right.
As you're seeing in this war in Ukraine over the past year, we're still in a battle for the hearts and minds of many countries, in particular in the global south, in terms of whose narrative to believe in terms of what's transpired in and around Ukraine. And the Russian narrative, which is filled with propaganda and lies in the case of what they've put forward in terms of their rationale for the invasion and what they've done, nevertheless does resonate even if the United States has changed its tactics in terms of how it's handling information.
You know, you brought up earlier in our discussion about the importance of economics, economic considerations, global trade, and things like that. About a decade ago, we were talking about the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, as these rising economic powers to be looked at for the future. Interestingly enough, the two countries that that don't seem to be coming down on America's side right now with regards to, you know, condemning Russia are India and Brazil. It's kind of a fascinating thing, and I don't know where this goes from there. I want to pivot over to the Munich Security Conference. You recently attended the Munich Security Conference as a longtime attendee of that important event. What can you tell us about the agenda, the security challenges and opportunities addressed by speakers and delegates, and anything else you think people should know about what happened at this year's Munich Conference? There really wasn't much good press coverage about that conference this year and what came from it.
So the Munich Security Conference is really unique. It's now over 60 years that the conference has been held. And it's always been put on by a private foundation. It's not an arm of the German government, for example. And it's been designed over many decades to bring together primarily voices throughout the Euro-Atlantic region, across Europe, to discuss various issues, and is attended at very senior levels of government, presidents, prime ministers, foreign ministers, defense ministers, national security advisors. A lot of governments have very large delegations who attend Munich. And there's been a number of significant events that have happened there over the years. At least now, I'll highlight that in my time at Munich, which goes back a little over 10 years, I've been going to the conference now since, I think, 2012, the Russians have been represented at very senior levels. Vladimir Putin gave a very famous speech at the 2007 Munich Security Conference, where in some ways he laid out the template for how he saw Europe in terms of the enlargement of NATO and what it meant for Russia's security, and in some ways telegraphed some of the actions that he's taken recently. So it's been a very serious event, probably the most significant security conference globally over that time, and by the way, has evolved now to include countries outside the Euro-Atlantic region. So China is represented at the Munich Security Conference. India is represented. A lot of African countries, and not just regional, but also functional issues like global health. The head of the WHO was at the conference this year, for example. So it's diversified. But I have to say, this year's conference really was a departure from the conferences that I've attended in the past and the conferences that have been held, you know, throughout the conference's history. In one significant way, which is the Russians were disinvited.
Right.
And my own personal view is that was a mistake. I think, you know, we benefit from hearing the arguments of our adversaries and forcing them to make them publicly and exposing them to the light of day.
That's diplomacy.
and you know, to hear it publicly from leaders is really when a lot of our publics pay attention. And we missed that opportunity at Munich. We didn't hear from the Russians at Munich. I don't think their case would have been all that compelling. Lavrov recently was laughed off of a stage a couple of weeks ago. But we should have given him the opportunity to be laughed off the Munich stage.
Yes.
And we didn't. And by the way, the conference, which is still put together by a private foundation, this year, perhaps not surprisingly, but it's worth noting, was much more of a conference organized in support of Ukraine.
Yeah.
It was not a single issue conference, but that issue really dominated, and much of the conference agenda was organized that way. So that's a bit different. I wouldn't be surprised if the Russians, even if invited, don't show up at Munich again anytime soon. So we lose that opportunity for engagement and we lose that opportunity for dialogue because a lot of Munich, it's a mess. If you've ever been to the Munich Security Conference, it takes place in one hotel. There's about 1,000 attendees, although they've cut that back to try and make it a little bit more manageable. And there's a major conference hall within the hotel where the speeches are given. But much of the diplomacy that takes place is basically who you bump into in the hallways and the elevators and the coffee houses and the restaurants. And those are important opportunities for engagement. And not having the Russians there, in particular at a time when, you know, we're at an unprecedented crisis in Euro-Atlantic security. We haven't seen anything like this, you know, really since the collapse of the Soviet Union and even decades before. I think that was a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that you, I mean, diplomacy only works if you're actually talking to each other. And I think we have to move in the direction of finding a way to end this. I personally think that the strategy is that NATO has adopted. Maybe you can give me your perspective on this. But I think that the strategy that NATO decided to adopt shortly after the invasion, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, was that we were going to force the Russians to continue to invest more and more manpower and material into the fight and give the Ukrainians enough to resist and to defeat the Russians inside Ukraine, but not give the Ukrainians enough to throw the Russians out, which creates a whole separate set of opportunities for Putin to take action. But he's invested himself. We've got him sort of trapped in a conundrum that he can't get out of, and we want to make sure that he continues to suffer until the Russian people remove him from power. Would you agree with that strategy, or do I have that? Am I reading it right?
So I think you've hit the major lines. The quandary that we have now, and by we, I include Ukraine first and foremost, but yeah. Ukraine's friends
right.
in Europe, and that includes the United States and it includes NATO, is how to stop the killing.
Right.
And end the fighting. Now, if you assume that Ukraine, armed by NATO, can actually drive Russia from every inch of Ukrainian territory and Crimea, then your answer to the question of when to stop the fighting is not until the Ukrainians have accomplished that. If you don't think that the Ukrainians are going to be capable of doing that, and that either side is going to be able to achieve total victory, that is, the Russians are not going to be able to, as they hoped to do a year ago,
right.
Remove the government in Kyiv and basically take over Ukraine. And if you don't believe that's now possible, and I don't think Russians can achieve that objective. And if you don't think the Ukrainians are capable of driving the Russians out of every inch of Ukrainian territory, including Crimea, then you have to conclude that the war ends not on the battlefield, but around the diplomatic table.
Right.
But right now, the Russians and Ukrainians are not talking.
Nope.
They haven't spoken since March of last year. And right now, Ukraine's friends aren't encouraging them to talk. Hubert Humphrey famously talked about the difficulties of the peacemaker and how difficult it is for the first person to say, we need to stop and end the fighting. And that's where we are right now in Ukraine. It's very difficult for a peacemaker to step forward and say, we should be focused on a cessation of hostilities so we can get around the diplomatic table. So the fighting happens around the conference table and not on the battlefield. That's not where the two combatants are.
No.
Both Russia and Ukraine believe that they can still make significant gains on the battlefield. And until they conclude otherwise, it's going to be difficult to stop the war around the conference table.
Yeah, the challenge, I think, is that the Russians continue to signal certain objectives, war objectives, that are diametrically opposed to what President Zelensky in Ukraine could ever possibly accept. On behalf of the Ukrainian people. And the Ukrainian people certainly don't want the status quo where it is right now. So it puts all of the supporters of Ukraine in a difficult position because you want to make sure that Zelensky is the one that you're backing, that you know his voice is the one that is in the room. When he signals that he's willing to accept something different, then the international community that's been supporting Ukraine can probably back off a little bit. But I don't see Putin changing his war objectives anytime soon.
I think President Zelensky may be in the most difficult position in this conflict when it comes to diplomacy. The rhetoric of President Zelensky and the Ukrainian government is one of total victory, driving the Russians out of every inch of Ukrainian territory, including Crimea. And by the way, they've actually gained back about half of the territory, right, roughly, that the Russians gained in the opening months of the war. The Ukrainians have fought heroically and valiantly and effectively. And my guess is they're going to make continuing gains on the battlefield. But at some point, both sides may reach a point of exhaustion. This war is costing both sides a tremendous amount in terms of men, women, material, civilian casualties, in particular on the Ukrainian side, obviously. The support that Ukraine is getting from NATO countries, the European Union, and the United States is also incredibly resource-intensive and costly.
Yes.
And so it's not clear that that status quo can continue. And President Zelensky at some point may have to decide at what point he is going to transition from trying to achieve his objectives, not just on the battlefield, but at the conference table. I think it's an argument that he can make. In other words, he doesn't have to concede the territory of Crimea. He doesn't have to concede any other inch of ground. But he might be able to agree to a cessation of hostilities and try and negotiate a more favorable end to the conflict than to fight his way to a more favorable end to the conflict. But it will be difficult for him to do that.
Yeah, and the challenge, of course, is when you give, say, the Russians the opportunity to breathe, they have time to rearm and re-equip and train their troops better, and then it's a tougher opponent if you don't succeed at the diplomacy angle, which is hard.
So I'll just say in 60 seconds or less, there's going to be many different phases in ending this war.
Right.
Again, if you assume that neither side is going to achieve total victory,
right,
it will probably begin with a cessation of hostilities and transition to a more permanent ceasefire. That will probably be a complicated process in and of itself, but also accompanied by an even more complicated process, which is how do you transition to a peace agreement where both sides feel secure and you don't face a situation where 5 years later
you're again.
Exactly, the conflict has restarted.
Right.
And that probably will involve security guarantees for Ukraine. I don't think it includes NATO membership, but they're going to want a more, how should I say, secure situation than they had prior to this war breaking out, first in 2014 and then again in 2022. And the Russians are probably going to have some arrangement that they also believe is stable and sustainable if we're going to diminish the prospects of a new fight. It can be done. I note that the model may be something along the lines of what we've achieved on the Korean Peninsula, where we have an armistice. We're still waiting for a peace agreement.
Right.
But the large-scale fighting between the sides that my father participated in hasn't happened now for over 70 years.
Right. Steve Andreasen, unfortunately, we are almost out of time today. I was hoping to get in and talk about a bunch of different crises around the world. Maybe I could ask you to come back again, maybe over the summer or early fall, if you're available, and we can continue on a conversation along those lines.
I'd be really happy to do that. I mean, the one thing I wanted to talk to you about that we didn't get to is the war in Tigray and northern Ethiopia.
Let's talk about that real quick before we move on. Where do you see that situation unfolding? I know they just signed a sort of a peace deal, but
so many people think the largest war in the world the last 2 years has been the war in Ukraine. It's actually been in northern Ethiopia in the Tigray region. A conflict broke out just after our presidential election in November of 2020, and basically there has been a war in northern Ethiopia, a conspiracy really between the government of Abiy Ahmed and the government led by President Isaias in Eritrea to crush the Tigray region and the leaders of Tigray. The conflict has included war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and I would argue genocide. Over a million people killed, combatants and civilians. There has been recently a cessation of hostilities and negotiations on a more permanent agreement, but it raises real issues for the United States. We are quick to, and rightly, label Vladimir Putin a war criminal. The International Criminal Court has basically said that he should be marched to the docket, so to speak, in terms of his actions. But Abiy Ahmed and President Isaias, who led this conflict against Tigray, are still leading their countries. And now that the war has, paused, it raises real issues for the United States. How do we deal with countries led by leaders that have perpetuated these kinds of acts and crimes, in this case, against their own people? And how do we deal with that in terms of post-conflict justice? And how do we deal with it in terms of U.S. policy? Do we restore our bilateral relations with Ethiopia? It hasn't been a proud moment in U.S. national security and foreign policy with respect to Ethiopia, but that's true of much of the international community. And that's an issue that we could spend an hour on.
We certainly could. Abiy Ahmed, didn't he win the Nobel Peace Prize?
He did indeed. And shortly thereafter, he and his partner, President Isaias, as I say, conspired to begin the war against the Tigray region. And the leaders of Tigray, who up until Abiy Ahmed, since the early 1990s, had basically been, quote, the ruling class, unquote, in many respects, of Ethiopia. So there's a large history behind this conflict. It's one, as I say, that you and I could at least attempt to unravel over the course of another show. But there's other issues, too, the U.S.-China relationship, Taiwan. If you want to know the disaster for the 21st century, it would be a war over Taiwan.
No question.
It would destroy the Asia-Pacific region. Militarily, economically, and have dramatic implications for our children and grandchildren.
No question.
So that's another hour program. Your work cut out for you, John.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing we have a show every Wednesday morning to where we can tackle a new topic. I would offer you the last few minutes to cover whatever you want, but I think that's probably going to be it. We actually ran a little overtime right now. We'll have to bring things to a close for today. Steve Andresen, you serve as the National Security Consultant to the Nuclear Threat Initiative, and you're also a professor at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Thank you so much for joining us today.
So, John, I just want to say thank you, and thank you for your service. I think you're the best informed person I know on national security and foreign policy, in large part because of this program. It's a real public service, and I appreciate you doing it.
Well, thank you so much, Steve, for making the drive down today. And that closes this edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today here on KYMN Radio. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns, is brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check out their website at cybersecuritysummit.org for a list of their upcoming webinar series. And now, your host, John Olson.
95.1.
The One.